Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Turkey's President Erdogan arrives in Washington tomorrow for a meeting with President Trump. U.S.-Turkish relations are now the worst since World War II, with deep concerns over Turkey's military move into Syria, where Turkish proxies may be committing war crimes, according to Amnesty International and U.S. officials, over Russian weapons systems and NATO. While a formal U.S.-Turkey relationship may be strained, the personal regard between President Trump and President Erdogan is strong, so could that save the alliance? This hour on Point, Turkey, the U.S., and NATO, and what tomorrow's visit may bring. What do you make of the relationship between Presidents Erdogan and Trump? Do you see a relationship of trust and respect between the two countries? And could that lead to a relationship of trust and respect across the alliance here between the U.S., Turkey, and NATO? Or is that very alliance coming apart at the seams? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, before we talk specifically about the U.S. and Turkey, I want to spend a moment talking about NATO itself, because last week, French President Emmanuel Macron said of the Transatlantic Alliance, quote, what we are currently experiencing is the brain death of NATO. Well, joining me from Berlin is Matthew Karnichnig. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. Matt, welcome back to On Point.
Hello.
So Emmanuel Macron saying they're experiencing the brain death of NATO. He told that to The Economist. What was he talking about?
Well, he was specifically referring to what happened in Syria with the U.S. decision to pull out from Syria and to stop supporting the Kurds there. That was a decision, Macron said, that had been made without consulting the other NATO allies. Both France and the UK also have forces in the region, and they were obviously very surprised when this happened. And he was saying this isn't the way one should be dealing with partners, and he's no longer sure whether France can rely on the United States or whether NATO can rely on the United States. And to make matters even worse, when The Economist journalist asked him if Article 5, which is really the bedrock of the NATO alliance, the mutual defense clause, which basically says that an attack on one is an attack on all, when they asked him if that was still valid, he said, I don't know. So it really has done immeasurable damage to the confidence of a lot of people in Europe, in Western Europe in particular right now, about the future of the alliance.
Well, so in years past, when President Trump seemed to question the strength of Article 5, he was roundly criticized for it. What are NATO member countries saying now that Emmanuel Macron says, I don't know about Article 5?
Well, that's absolutely right. President Trump said a couple of years ago that he thought NATO was obsolete or was in danger of becoming obsolete, and he walked those comments back a little bit. I think that the fact that it's coming from Macron, who is seen as a very kind of, you know, stable, reasonable leader in Europe, in the core of the European alliance, is also very worrisome. I think when Trump said it, it obviously was something that shocked a lot of people. It was at a time when people in Europe weren't really used to Trump, and you know, a lot of the mixed signals that he gives on various issues. But the fact that it is coming from France, I think, was something that unnerved a lot of people in smaller countries, in particular, on the fringes of the NATO alliance. If you look to the Baltic region, to Poland, places like that, where, you know, the prospect of some kind of Russian action is not really theoretical, because they're seeing it happen right on their doorstep.
Right. So specifically, I'm seeing here that Chancellor Angela Merkel in Germany had some pretty sharp words for her French counterpart, calling Macron's words drastic. That's not my point of view. She said, quote, I don't think that such sweeping judgments are necessary, even if we have problems and need to pull together. NATO remains vital to our security. Let's listen to a little bit of how U.S. officials responded. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He was in Leipzig, Germany last week, and he dismissed what Emmanuel Macron says and credits the cooperation of NATO allies for the fall of the Berlin Wall.
There we were in this place where nations of democratic values worked so closely together for a long time to achieve what happened in 1989 and then again in 1990. A remarkable work that created freedom and brought millions of people out of very, very difficult situations. I think NATO remains an important, critical, perhaps historically one of the most critical strategic partnerships in all of recorded history.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo last week in Germany. Matt, let me ask you, I mean, if Emmanuel Macron is going to rock the boat as much as he did about sort of bedrock presumptions regarding the NATO alliance, did he have any suggestions on what transatlantic partners might do to strengthen the alliance or specifically what European nations might do?
Yes, absolutely. And this is exactly where he would like the focus to be, is on more European defense, more focus on Europeans getting together to come up with their own defense policy. And there are various initiatives already underway in that regard. But if you look at this closely, you can see that, you know, compared to what the U.S. spends on defense and American capabilities, it would really take probably decades, most military experts here say, for Europe to build the kind of capabilities that the United States has. And there doesn't really seem to be a real will on the part of the populations in Europe to do so. I mean, they're quite comfortable with the system now, with the partnership that they have with the United States. And some people say, well, you know, France is France, and they've always had a somewhat a difficult relationship with NATO. Charles de Gaulle, who was the president of France after World War II, at one point actually pulled them out of NATO for a while and stopped cooperating militarily with the alliance. So France has always had a bit of a one-foot-in, one-foot-out position vis-a-vis NATO. That said, his statements, Macron's statements coming now as all of these issues appear to be kind of coming to a head with, you know, the provocations that we're seeing from Russia in Ukraine and elsewhere is really making people nervous. And that's why I think you saw the immediate response almost from Chancellor Merkel, which is quite rare for her to respond with such force and so quickly to something a close ally like France has said.
Well, Matt Karnischnig is chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe, speaking to us from Berlin. We've got links to his reporting on NATO at onpointradio.org. Matt, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Let's focus now on the U.S. and Turkey and relations over deep concerns about what's happening in Syria and the region at large. And joining us now is Lara Seligman. She's with us from Washington. She's Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy. Lara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magda. Thanks for having me.
So I do want to sort of use this NATO story to pivot to the U.S. and Turkey. But in order to do that, let me just read you a quick comment that we got on our website from one of our listeners, from B. Sean Clark, who says, the situation in the Middle East remains one that calls for international cooperative effort to help the regional players and stakeholders mediate their differences, or at least come up with a system of mediating the constant conflicts between them. And then B. Sean says, there is a NATO for war, but none for peace. Is that what we're seeing now in these sort of erupting tensions here between NATO allies?
Well, I think that's definitely an interesting point, but I would also point out that there is an ongoing war right now in Syria, and especially since Erdogan and his Turkish forces and their Turkish proxies invaded northeastern Syria on October 9th. I mean, this is really happening on the ground. There are videos of these militia basically committing atrocities, targeting Syrian Kurdish civilians deliberately, releasing Islamic State prisoners, executing prisoners, and targeting this a female politician that was in the news recently. So this is really happening on the ground, and U.S. lawmakers are starting to take note of it, as well as international aid groups. So in fact, some House lawmakers are calling on President Donald Trump still to rescind Erdogan's invitation to Washington due to these atrocities. And Erdogan himself, in fact, almost didn't come. There's a lot of different issues on the table that are lending themselves to frosty relations between Washington and Ankara right now. One of those, of course, is the ongoing crisis, but there's a few others. First of all, the House last week or the week before condemned the massacre of 1.5 million Armenians by the Ottoman Empire as an act of genocide. So that's something that has caused a lot of disruption in the relationship as well. There's also the issue about the F-35 fighter jet, a U.S.-made jet that Turkey had planned to purchase, but then Turkey decided to purchase the Russian-made S-400, a missile system that U.S. and NATO officials say threatens the F-35, which is a jet that many European countries will also fly. And a few months ago, the U.S. decided to kick Turkey out of the F-35 program because they received their first shipments of the S-400. So now it seems like ahead of Trump, a deadline for Trump to impose sanctions on Ankara as a result of this S-400 purchase, seems like there's a little bit of wiggle room. Trump has said to Erdogan, if you deactivate these missile systems, then perhaps we can put you back into the F-35 program. But it still remains to be seen whether these two leaders will be able to see eye to eye on a number of issues.
Do we know that they're going to be talking about the F-35 specifically? I mean, maybe I should ask, we've got 30 seconds before we have to take a break, Laura, but what's sort of the big hope that could come out of Wednesday's meeting?
Well, I think I think the first and foremost issue is the incursion into Syria. I think that's on a lot of people's minds right now, whether Turkey is going to actually prosecute some of these war crimes, but then also hopefully resolve the F-35 S-400 issue, because as U.S. officials say, Turkey is a key NATO ally and we want to keep these issues separate.
So, Laura, stand by here for just a second. We will be taking a break. We're looking at the relationship between the United States and Turkey right now, and what can be done to repair a frayed alliance. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the frayed relations between the United States and Turkey as Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is scheduled to make a visit to Washington, to the White House, tomorrow. I'm joined today by Laura Seligman. She's with us from Washington. She's Pentagon correspondent for foreign policy. And Laura, I just want to play a quick clip of what happened during President Erdogan's Washington visit back in 2017, because then Turkish-American protesters were attacked and some badly injured by Erdogan's own security team. Though those Turks also got into fights with U.S. law enforcement. And here was NBC News' Andrea Mitchell reporting on the violence.
You could call it a bodyguard riot. Security men guarding Turkey's President Erdogan, kicking and pummeling protesters outside the Turkish embassy Tuesday in one of Washington's fanciest neighborhoods. 11 people injured, 2 seriously. 2 protesters arrested.
Now, Laura, that incident, if I can call it that, I mean, I think it really it left a bad feeling in Washington around Erdogan's last visit, didn't it?
Yeah, it definitely did. There were protests, like you said, in one of Washington's fanciest neighborhoods. The security detail, Erdogan security detail, clashed with protesters as well as attacking Secret Service. And I think that's certainly added to the tension that's been going on in the last couple years between Ankara and Washington. But, I mean, that it's sort of a chicken and egg situation, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of tension before that. There's a lot of things that Turkey is doing the United States takes issue with. But on the other hand, I mean, this goes back years and years to the beginning, sort of in the middle of the Syrian civil war, when Turkey and Russia clashed, and Turkey believed that the United States did not do enough to stand up for Turkey. Then, of course, there was the issue of Washington arming the YPG militia, which Turkey views as an offshoot of the PKK, a terrorist group in Turkey. But, of course, now the U.S. calls them the Syrian Democratic Forces. And that's always been a big, big issue for Ankara. And I think a lot of people really underestimate how much of a problem that is. In fact, some people argue that Turkey sees the YPG or the SDF, the Syrian Kurds, as even a bigger problem than ISIS in Syria and in the region. So that's one of the things that's contributing to tensions as well.
So, Lara, let me ask you one question based on a comment that's come in on our website. QuizCat says, what progressives cannot figure out is that Trump's decision to allow Turkey to extend itself into Syria lays the groundwork for NATO to expel Turkey from NATO. Turkey no longer has any business being in an alliance with NATO. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that there are certainly people that are making that argument. I mean, the incursion into Syria, the war crimes that are being committed is just the latest thing, really, that Turkey is doing to upset the NATO alliance. Among them, one of the bigger ones is moving closer and closer to Russia, which is one of the things that Erdogan and Trump will be discussing with this S-400 purchase at the White House this week, we believe. So there's certainly a case to be made for at least discussing whether Turkey should be part of the NATO alliance. But I do believe that many U.S. officials would, and NATO officials would say that Turkey is still a cornerstone of the alliance. They are NATO's southern front against Russia. Incirlik Air Base is the fundamental base that U.S. and NATO forces use to fight in the Middle East. You know, they're really, really important to the region and regional stability. So I think there's a big discussion that's going to be going on in the next months and years over whether Turkey really should remain a NATO member. And I think, to some extent, Erdogan needs to, you know, fix relations with the West if he wants to stay in NATO.
Well, Lara Seligman, Pentagon correspondent for Foreign Policy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, Lara did mention about the Turkish decision to buy a Russian missile system, despite being a NATO member, and how that has not gone over well with Washington. Here is President Trump back in July announcing that his administration would cancel the sale of American-made fighter jets in response.
Because they have a system of missiles that's made in Russia, they're now prohibited from buying over 100 planes. I would say that Lockheed isn't exactly happy. We are now telling Turkey that because you have really been forced to buy another missile system, we're not going to sell you the F-35 fighter jets.
President Trump back in July. And as we're noting, we're having this conversation today because he's about to meet President Erdogan in Washington tomorrow. So joining us now from Washington is Aykan Erdemir, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a former member as well of the Turkish parliament with the center-right Republican People's Party. He's also a founding member of the International Panel of Parliamentarians for Freedom of Religion or Belief. Aykan Erdemir, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Ambassador Robert Pearson. He joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003 and is now a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Ambassador Pearson, welcome to you.
Thank you, Megna.
So let me ask you both, and I'll start with you. How would you characterize the current state of the U.S.-Turkey relationship? Is it at a nadir over the past, compared to the past, I don't know, 25, 50 years?
I think it's safe to say that this is an all-time low in bilateral relations because the crisis is not just around a single issue. It is around a long list of issues ranging from the purchase of the Russian air defense system to an ongoing trial against Turkey's second largest public lender for Iran's sanctions evasion, to Turkey's cross-border operation and accusations of war crimes in northeast Syria, to the attack against protesters in Sheridan Circle in Washington, D.C. So this shows that on multiple fronts, there are a range of issues. And I would argue that that stems mostly from the nature of the current Turkish government, which is a majoritarian, authoritarian, and sectarian Justice and Development Party government. Erdogan has been in power since 2002, and the trajectory of his policies have put these two allies on a crash course. Mm-hmm. Crash course, but not only U.S.-Turkish relations, but also Turkey's relations with the European Union as well as with other NATO allies.
Right. Well, Ambassador Pearson, I mean, let's talk in detail about the relationship that President Trump has with President Erdogan, because, you know, if President Trump has been consistent on anything, it's that he does place a great amount of import on personal relationships and also sort of transactional nature of relationships between himself and other foreign leaders. And, you know, the president back in 2012, when those Trump towers opened in Istanbul, he called Erdogan highly respected, a good man representing Turkey very well. So should we look upon that affection now as a potential pathway to repairing the formal alliances between these two countries? Or should we see that as possibly, a hindering effect here that perhaps the president may not be able to argue in the best interests of the United States?
You know, I think that these two men are really gaming each other. I don't think that President Trump has a really deep affection for Mr. Erdogan at all, and I don't think Mr. Erdogan has a deep affection for the president. I think they both feel that by acting this way and behaving this way, each might gain something that they otherwise wouldn't have. Mr. Trump has alternatively praised Mr. Erdogan and imposed sanctions with no notice and withdrawn them with no notice, sent a rather unusual diplomatic letter to Mr. Erdogan just a couple of weeks ago. Mr. Erdogan makes a practice of condemning the United States for supporting terrorism. And so I don't really think this is much more than the way they play the game. But it does leave an atmosphere in which some measure of a semblance of cooperation could emerge that would sound like it was consistent with the attitude they have towards each other. I just wouldn't put much reliance on any personal affection that exists between these two people.
Interesting. Well, Icahn, what do you think about that? Because I'm seeing other people quoted recently, for example, in the New York Times, saying that these two leaders have an affinity for each other as strongman presidents, and it's the only component of the U.S.-Turkey relationship that's working right now.
I think Erdogan really invests in what he believes is a personal rapport between himself and Trump. And not only that, there was a New York Times expose earlier today, which shows that there are also other members of the Trump and Erdogan families involved. In fact, the piece argued that there were son-in-law backdoor diplomacy, that U.S.-Turkish relations are at this point at an interpersonal level, not at an inter-institutional level. And I think that is the big risk we have here, because Turkey's membership in NATO, Turkey's deepening of ties with the European Union and the United States and NATO have all been built on strong institutional foundations. And now that we have jettisoned that heritage and try to move on a very personal, subjective level, I think that is prone to risks.
Okay. I want to come back to that in a moment, Icahn. But Ambassador Pearson, I do want to hear from you. You heard Icahn say that he thinks that this is U.S.-Turkey relations are at an all-time low. And I wonder if you might – do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think – what are the consequences of the all-time low?
Well, I think they are at an all-time low. at least in memory, they are at an all-time low. And I think that there are, as was said, a number of very difficult issues that now face the relationship between the two countries, and those have built up over the years. So Mr. Erdogan wants to have Turkey become really an independent player on the global stage, economically and militarily, and he thinks that the United States has somehow prevented that from happening, and so he doesn't have any goodwill that I can see towards the United States at all. And I think he will come to Washington as a person who has to prove to his home audience that he can make demands and receive them, the benefits, and he can do this because of his so-called personal relationship with Mr. Trump. I just don't see that there is an opportunity here for much progress. I do think, though, that the two countries recognize fundamentally that they are not going to split. And by the way, there is no kick-out clause in the NATO alliance. There is no provision for removing a country from the NATO alliance. So these two countries, I think, will continue to work on the issues that face them, but they have a much steeper hill to climb now than ever before.
Well, Aykan Erdemir, then reflect on what the ambassador just said here. What do you think Erdogan's goals are for Turkey, and has he been consistent in his desire for those goals since he first came to office and even survived that attempted coup back in 2016?
Erdogan's foreign and security policy goals have been all over the place over the last decade and a half. What has remained consistent is his strong drive for political survival, his strong drive to consolidate power and turn Turkey into a one-man rule. And hence, at this point, we see that most of these foreign policy moves are actually connected to what he's trying to achieve back at home. The cross-border operation into northeast Syria is more about deflecting the public attention away from the economic crisis at home. He is also trying to overcome the embarrassment of losing local elections, not once, but twice after he canceled the Istanbul elections. There has been splits from his party as his senior aides are, on path to set up their own parties. So Erdogan cares deeply about maintaining his personal empire in Turkey. And he will do whatever it takes in foreign and security policy to achieve these. So now, ahead of tomorrow's meeting with President Trump, he will be deeply concerned about a potential sanction against the S-400 purchase, CATSA sanctions. He will be deeply concerned about the lawsuit against Turkey's second largest public lender for Iran sanction evasion and a potential fine out of that case. So most of his goals are at this point personal goals around issues of political survival.
Hmm. Now, Aykan, just sort of generally speaking, alliances rely on assurances of mutual aid, mutual benefit, and responding to mutual need. I'm just wondering, what does Turkey, or specifically, what does Erdogan see as how Turkey benefits or should benefit from a close and healthy relationship with the United States?
I think Erdogan might learn the hard way what the United States and NATO really mean for Turkey. Erdogan has been the most welcoming of Turkish leaders toward Russia, toward deepening Russian influence in Turkey. And I think he failed to realize that Turkey enjoys the rights and freedoms it still has thanks to NATO's umbrella. Turkey has never become a satellite state of the Soviet Union, and during the Cold War managed to, retain its parliamentary democracy, its relative market freedoms. And now that Turkey is turning its back not only to the transatlantic alliance, but also its values, I think Turkey could fall prey to Russian as well as, Iranian hegemonic ambitions in the region. And I think this is one issue Erdogan still needs to contemplate about, But given that he has sidelined Turkey's bureaucracy, Turkey's, you know, foreign ministry, Turkey's academia and intellectuals, he doesn't have the intellectual firepower around him to remind him of the lessons of Turkish history.
Well, Ambassador Pearson, we just have about a minute to go before the break, but let me ask you sort of the flip side of that question. Lara Seligman earlier called Turkey NATO's southern front. Given President Trump's sort of mercurial views on NATO itself, do you think that Washington or the Trump administration adequately recognizes Turkey's importance to the United States?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think in the past, Washington's made mistakes about dealing with Turkey. It's treated Turkey as a geographic space on the map and therefore very important to the alliance, instead of treating Turkey as a country that could be democratic and trying to focus on that aspect of the issues as much as on the defense issues. I think it's very important that the United States and Turkey find a way to keep going forward, even if the present circumstance makes us think that it's almost a flat line.
Ambassador, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought because we have to take a really quick break. We're talking about U.S.-Turkey relations. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is scheduled to visit Washington and the White House tomorrow, so we're using that as an opportunity to talk about the current state of U.S.-Turkey relations, which seem to be at an all-time low. I'm joined today by Aykan Erdemir. He's Senior Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a former member of the Turkish Parliament with the center-right Secular Republican People's Party. Ambassador Robert Pearson joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He served as U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003 and is now a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Ambassador Pearson, forgive me for having had to interrupt you to take that break, but we were talking about whether the Trump administration recognizes the importance of Turkey to the United States. And just go ahead and complete your thought.
No, I think that it does. But I think that this is going to be a difficult meeting because Mr. Erdogan's approach will be one of making demands about Syria, about trade with the U.S., for example. The U.S. talks about a $100 billion joint trade relationship between the two countries. But even this year, that trade relationship was $20 billion. So we're talking about a fivefold increase, which is really practically impossible. The F-35s, he's going to make demands about that. He's going to talk about Kurdish-American cooperation. He's going to try to relieve a state-owned bank in Turkey of the consequences of an indictment for massive fraud, trading gold to the Iranians for oil that the Iranians shipped out to the world in order to avoid international sanctions. He's going to ask for a return of the minister in Islamic minister in Pennsylvania, Mr. Gulen, to Turkey, and he's probably going to raise the Armenian genocide resolution that the House passed. So there are a lot of issues on the table that are going to be difficult, and the Turkish negotiating style is usually to make a demand and consider the other side responsible for finding a solution. So how this plays to the American public will make a great difference in the final evaluation of how successful his visit is, and I'm not sure that he understands that truth.
Okay, interesting. Ambassador, just to follow up, so that's the Turkish negotiating style. What is the U.S. going to ask for or demand in return? You just read a laundry list of things that Erdogan wants. It, you know, is President Trump or should President Trump say, fine, but stop committing war crimes in northern Syria through your proxies?
Well, that's more or less a single or two or three incidents, and that's not going to affect the strategic relationship. That is an embarrassing thing, and it does show the lack of Turkish control over their Syrian forces. And in fact, Turkey relies on al-Qaeda forces in the little province of Idlib to maintain control there. So I think that the U.S. should promote the concept of increased trade with Turkey and do everything possible to put the two business communities together. I think that'd be very helpful. I think that both these leaders need to show they're managing a crisis. But in the back pocket of the American side are the denial options. That is sanctions, continued prosecution of the bank, denial of the F-35. And these are leverages that can be used with Turkey to make the Turkish position more realistic and more practical. And I hope they will come into play. But given the approach that Mr. Trump has taken thus far, I have my doubts.
Well, so Aykan Erdemir, pick up on that thought. I mean, do you think Congress would be able to pass resolutions against Turkey that could survive a presidential veto, I guess?
I think that's really the key question both Erdogan and Trump have in their minds. Erdogan's visit is about blocking a veto-proof Senate majority. He knows that his best bet is with Mr. Trump. He hopes that the U.S. president can continue to shield him from sanctions and he can continue to enjoy the impunity he has enjoyed so far. However, that is a risky plan. We have seen that in a very divided, polarized Washington, what brings all Congress people across the political spectrum together is their moral outrage against Erdogan. We have seen two votes in the House where we have seen overwhelming majorities, both on sanctions and on the Armenian genocide issue. And this shows that Erdogan has become a liability, has become very toxic, not only for himself, but also for his U.S. counterpart, President Trump. So I think this is one calculation Erdogan needs to make again if he is not experience a surprise majority again.
Okay, so Aykan, let me ask you, and perhaps this is just too pedestrian a question, but I cannot resist. What did President Trump expect when he decided to pull most U.S. troops out of northern Syria? I mean, Erdogan and the Turkish government under Erdogan has been very clear for years about its posture on about the Kurds. Is this a willful misreading on the part of the president? Because if we're talking about where we are now, so much of it stems from that decision by President Trump.
That withdrawal is really very puzzling because it's not only bad policy, but it's also a case where Trump robbed himself of a rare success story during his presidency. Because when we take a closer look at what has taken place in northeast Syria is, this is the leanest U.S. involvement in the Middle East. We're talking about around 1,000 special forces. This has been the most effective. You know, the Islamic State has been defeated. We are talking about building of inclusive institutions, which has always been a key shortcoming of U.S. engagements in the Middle East. In northeast Syria, in the territory under the control of the Syrian Democratic Council, the SDC, we have seen Kurds, Arabs, Yazidis, Syriac Christians, Armenians, Turkmen coming together under relatively inclusive institutions. Definitely there have been shortcomings, but this was one oasis of peaceful coexistence. And Trump could have said, this is my legacy, this is my success story in a very lean and effective military engagement campaign. I have brought peace and coexistence to northeast Syria and compare this now to other parts of the Middle East. But then he just went ahead and destroyed this one rare success case he had and paved the way for a humanitarian crisis, paved the way for war crimes, and for decades of nightmare and not only for Turkey, but also for the U.S.
Ambassador Pearson, I just wonder what your view is on that question.
I completely agree. It's a disaster. The withdrawal of American forces from Syria and now the kind of halfway reentry to protect the oil fields has undermined the confidence of allies in the Arab world and in NATO, as President Macron has so clearly pointed out. There is a campaign allegedly against Iran, but Mr. Trump has now made it clear that he's not going to war with Iran, and he has given a severe blow to the Gulf allies who were willing to support a tough American stance there. And he has weakened Israel's security by allowing now the possibility of increased Iranian presence in Syria, including a supply line to Lebanon. And apparently he did this without telling the Israelis even one word. So it is an astonishing act of doing something that he always said he would do, which is, quote, end these endless wars. If he wants to end an endless war, he can start with Yemen, where the U.S. is supplying the equipment to the Saudis for a civil conflict that is going to have to be settled by diplomacy. And he still has not settled Afghanistan, even after 2 years of negotiation. So he had other opportunities to end endless wars, and he picked the wrong one.
Well, just as a reminder of how differently these two nations talk about recent events here, I just want to play a moment from when Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence flew to Turkey last month to negotiate that ceasefire in northeastern Syria, just hours after President Trump said that doing as such wasn't the U.S.'s responsibility. So here is Vice President Pence in Ankara claiming, although Turkish officials later said there was no negotiated ceasefire, but nevertheless, here's the Vice President talking about that ceasefire last month.
Today's ceasefire is a credit to President Trump and to President Erdogan. It's a credit to the strong relationship between the United States and Turkey. It's also a credit to the strong relationship between our two leaders.
Vice President Mike Pence last month. On the other hand, here's how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan talked about that same ceasefire or pause.
If it works, it works. If it doesn't, the minute 120 hours expire, we will continue from where we left and keep crushing the heads of the terrorists.
President Erdogan last month. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. Wow. This is a whole lot. I guess what I was interested in asking was, considering that it seems that both sides are bad faith actors when it comes to the betterment of this relationship, whether it's the Trump administration either not having the best interests of the United States at hand, but more the interests, economic interests inside that country of any strong man that he is working with, and the fact that either the Turkish administration is, or regime at this point, is negotiating in bad faith, in the Americans saying that there is a ceasefire, but then doubling back on that, or they are speaking honestly with each other and then lying to the Americans. I don't see how we really even have a real relationship right now. We might have a strongman wannabe and a strongman working to strengthen his resolve in Turkey, having a personal relationship, and whatever goes on behind closed doors, the American people aren't going to see until we actually see what happens either in Syria or in Turkey or whatever the administration decides to let go.
Mark, I'm going to take it back from you there because you've asked an interesting question, and I'll turn it back to our panel in just a second. But, Mark, thank you for your call. Let's go to Marianne, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. Marianne, you're on the air. What's your question for our panel?
Yes, I'd like your panel to address Donald Trump's business holdings in Istanbul. He refers to the two towers that he has in Istanbul. However, he doesn't own the real estate. It's my understanding he leases his name to the business owner who does own the real estate. So he has a personal interest. He from what I understand, earns millions of dollars for licensing his name on those two towers in Istanbul. And do you think that plays into any decision he may have with respect to pulling troops out of Syria?
Yeah, Marianne, I'm going to give our panel a chance to answer both of these questions in the last few minutes that we have. But thank you so much for your call. So, Ikhan Erdemir, first to you. You heard sort of echoes in both of those callers wanting to explore further the personal interests that President Trump has in Turkey, and you know, to echo what Mark said, he doesn't actually see a real U.S.-Turkish relationship beyond those personal interests right now. What's your response to that?
First of all, I think it's important to realize that Erdogan has a completely different set of talking points at home than in D.C. And understanding this divergence, understanding this kind of doublespeak is extremely important because he sounds extremely belligerent, anti-Western, anti-NATO, anti-U.S. at home. And I think that's the real Erdogan we have at hand. And I'm not sure whether President Trump is fully informed about who he is dealing with, that he's dealing with this authoritarian leader who has very different goals than those of NATO in politics. And when it comes to the personal side, you know, Trump once on a radio show admitted, this is before the elections, that he has, quote, a small conflict of interest in Turkey. And Erdogan has been at least once on the record threatening to bring down, you know, the sign Trump Tower in the Trump Towers in Istanbul, which would have, you know, led to a cost to President Trump. So it's difficult to know whether any of these economic calculations come into the scene. But I think ultimately the key problem here is the interpersonal level at which the bilateral relations continue. There is an urgent need to bring the relationship back to an institutional relationship.
Ambassador Pearson, what do you think when you hear Ikhan Erdemir say that he's not entirely sure that Donald Trump knows who he's dealing with in President Erdogan?
You know, I think that that is correct. But I also think that Mr. Trump at this moment in his presidency really needs to show some form of a success. And so I think that Mr. Erdogan's pressure on him for concession on one of these many things I mentioned is likely to result in some concession by Mr. Trump that will be pictured as a peacemaking process and a warmer relationship step. But that's I think, takes care of that issue. And I do think the business connections are a conflict of interest, and Mr. Erdogan is quite clever to know how to twist that knife to show that he has tools in his box as well to retaliate against the Americans and specifically Mr. Trump. On the question about the relationship, you know, geography can't be eliminated. So Turkey will exist, the United States will exist, and so there will be a relationship between these two countries. And the way you restart it, in my opinion, is to start with work on trade. The gross national product of Russia is one half that of California's. Russia is not an economic engine that will ever help Turkey. Mm. And so Turkey's future economically lies with the West. And so I would work on that side of the relationship and see if we can make some progress and work, as Mr. Erdemir has said before, on the democratization of Turkey's domestic political process and see if we can, in the long run, have a better ally and a good friend.
Yeah. I do wonder if President Trump offering some concessions to Erdogan might be seen diplomatically as peacemaking, but politically as capitulation to Erdogan. We'll have to see what happens on Wednesday. Ambassador Robert Pearson, he served as U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003. Thank you for joining us. And Ikhan Erdemir, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, thank you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.